Today's show is brought to you by Capital One's CreditWise app. Capital One created the CreditWise app so you can check your credit score anytime you want right in the app. It's free to everyone, so download CreditWise today. Availability depends on presence of credit history from TransUnion. CreditWise is offered by Capital One Bank USA, NA. 15-60 on the Western Conference. We're going to start with the Dallas Mavericks, go through the Utah Jazz in alphabetical order here, and let's get right to it here with the Dallas Mavericks, Danny.
They are 6-20, 2-5 for the second time since we did this, and we're recording this on Saturday, so if any of the stats seem a little off, that's why. 28th in offense, 24th in defense, 2% chance of making the playoffs according to 538, and they project them to be 14th in the West with 27 wins at the end of the year.
Yeah, did you watch that game against Utah yesterday?
I did. I went ballistic on Deron Williams at the end, but overall, I thought Dallas played well. Utah was a little bit off for the most part, but Dallas was fighting, and they look a lot more competitive than they did 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, they're a real team again now that with D-Will back, Wes Matthews is having maybe the best offensive season of his career. Barnes has fallen off a little bit, but he still has been effective. Devin Harris, at least not really much of an offensive player anymore, but at least gives them some modicum of competence. They've been getting some decent play out of Salah Mejri in the middle for the 15 minutes a game before he fouls out. So they've been all right. And the D-Will thing, I mean, for those who didn't see the play on Friday, they tied the game, a heroic comeback in the fourth quarter, and they called the play for D-Will to give it up and get a down screen coming out to the three-point line in a last shot situation. He got the ball with about 10 seconds left and shot it. He was open. It was a good shot, a three-pointer in a tie game, but his explanation afterwards was that he just started the play too early and he took responsibility as a point guard. But then even worse than that was that after Rodney Hood got the rebound, D-Will just assumed that they're going to call timeout, and then Hood just dribbled right past him and hit the game-winning three-pointer after they didn't call timeout. So not the best from Deron Williams back in Utah, where he still is the recipient of some sporadic booze due to his departure there.
Not like Enes Kanter booze, but booze nonetheless. And Dirk is still not on the way to practicing. And this was the most open I've heard him talk about the possibility of retirement potentially at the end of this year if he just can't do it.
Yeah, I had that note in there from a bit earlier. There was a later report of him saying that maybe he might be back around Christmas, which I guess is only
a week away
now. And he's kind of been out on the floor, but he was talking about that, hey, you know, if my body just hurts all the time, then he might retire at the end of the year. And the Mavs do have that team option, although you imagine if he wanted to play one more year, they would just pick that up or re-sign him to a decent contract. We'll see. I mean, I think just the grind for him, for guys like Steve Nash, Kobe, to even just get to where you can get on the court, much less be effective. It's just like basically 24/7 bodily maintenance. And that's even, you know, when you are playing well. So I certainly would understand it if you wanted to hang it up, especially if the Mavs, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me that maybe he would see who they draft. Not that that person is going to help him that much next year. And then, you know, if he could come back for another year at a lower salary and they could get someone in free agency that he feels like is going to make them at least back into the playoff picture again, maybe you'd play again. But if they really can't add that much to the team, that maybe you would just hang it up. That's just my own speculation, but we'll see how that ends up.
It also becomes challenging because as a player, if you're interested in Dallas, that playing with Dirk is probably a temporary proposition, if that, and he is a selling point, though they have plenty of other ones. And so if it's dependent on that, which it very well could be, then that could be a big challenge for Dallas.
We'll talk a little bit more about what Wes Matthews is doing. He has been outstanding. He is shooting 39% on threes and taking 61% of his shots behind the arc. Higher usage than we've seen from him, with him having to be more of a primary offensive option, but he actually has held up. I mean, to still be shooting that well on threes, taking as many as he is, his usage right now over 20%, which usually you'll see it a little bit below that for him as a guy who is known as a 3-and-D guy. He never turns it over, which is useful. And I mean, his footwork on three-pointers, he's not really, you know, a guy who hops into his shot. He's not necessarily, like, you know, that quick to get separation, and he's shooting more of a set shot. So it's very impressive that he's able to get as many threes off as he is. Like, he had this play last night against Utah where he started on the left side of the floor. He snaked the pick and roll, which is basically like when they ice you, force you to the baseline. And then once you get the screen, you kind of snake back to the middle instead of just going straight to the middle like you would on a normal side pick and roll. But he did that, was inside the 3-point line, took two steps back and ended up shooting a three from the top of the key that he made. It was really, you don't see that type of footwork from guys very often. And to be able to make that kind of a shot for him, I'm just glad to see him back and playing well. He's probably not the player he was defensively. He can't jump at all anymore. Doesn't get to the rim at all anymore. Not really getting out in transition, but he's been effective. He's living up to that contract that he signed. And he and Barnes together, that's like a totally competent NBA wing duo.
They're one of the only teams in the league that has solid play there and has questions all around, partially due to age and also partially just because all their guys on the perimeter are on the exterior, you know, so the point guard and center are all going to be free agents after this year. So except for Mejuri, who's played pretty well.
AJ Hammonds, their second round draft pick out of Purdue, who I think they gave three guaranteed years to. And it's going to be one actual thing about the new CBA that's going to be interesting is with minimum salaries going up so much, that's the minimum salary. So these guys like, you know, say a Jake Lehman or a Paul Zipser or someone like Hammonds, these guys who signed these 3-year guaranteed deals or 2-year guaranteed deals that are maybe, you know, it made sense to give them that. Another guy would be like George Niang, although I think he only has 1 year guaranteed. But those guys who were drafted kind of after 40 in the second round who got guaranteed money for more than a year, with the minimum salaries going up, that's going to be, you know, 1.3, 1.4 million. Great for them, but may not look as good for those teams. They're like, hey, this is so little, we might as well take a chance on, you know, the very small percentage that this guy actually works out. Now that actually gets to be a little bit more significant money.
It does. And there'll also be a challenge. I still haven't seen the exact specifics on it, that they're probably going to grandfather in some of the cap hits. So we're going to see more players that are in that minimum range that not their entire salary counts against the salary cap.
Oh, you know what? That might be the case. Although I think I only read that that's for rookie scale deals, which these would not be necessarily.
Correct. It's pretty much true for rookie scale, but from what I know, and there was a little conversation between Albert Nahmad and Bobby Marks, I think it's not entirely clear with those vet minimum type guy or those minimum type guys where it's going to work, but I assume they'll probably tailor it in a little bit, but you still have to pay them the money. And in some situations, that's what matters.
So I started to talk about AJ Hammonds, and he actually hit a three at one point. He had three fouls in 3 minutes with 3 points and 1 3-pointer. And then he immediately came out of the game and like, oh yeah, you know, that's not bad. He's a 7-footer. He just made a three. And then you're like, oh yeah, you saw him next to Rudy Gobert. He's the same age as Rudy Gobert. They're both 24. All right, let's move on to Denver.
Denver continuing to be compelling. 10-16, 3-3 since the last time we did this. 16th in offense, 26th in defense, 24% chance of making the playoffs. And right now they're projected to be the 9 seed in the West with 36 wins.
Yeah, that is, of course, significantly below Portland's projection, which we'll get to. And but yeah, 24% chance of the playoffs is not bad. And the big development for them is that they are going with a starting lineup of Wilson Chandler, Danilo Gallinari, and Nikola Jokic in the front court. And you remember they've been through several iterations. They started Jokic and Nurkic together. That was horrible. Then they had Fareed and Nurkic starting together. That was also horrible. Just playing in those two big alignments is not the best, but they're trying to see if Jokic and Nurkic could work together. I think they decided that the answer to that is no. And now Jokic is a better player than Nurkic. He's a better prospect than Nurkic. He should have been starting this whole time. They are going through this period where they're playing him, you know, basically 32 minutes a game, the last 16 minutes of each half. And so now in their game against Portland, Nurkic only played 5 minutes, despite the fact that Jokic was in foul trouble and he only played 19 minutes. But their new starting lineup killed it. Those are their three best front court players. They should be playing together. They're not stopping anyone defensively anyway. So you might as well just get your best offensive unit out there. And they destroyed Portland at home in their first game with that configuration.
We will have to see if that best offensive unit out there eventually includes Jamal Murray. They have this, now that Gary Harris is back, they have this three guard rotation. And of course, Jameer plays a lot too. It makes
sense. And Will Barton is still
in. And Will Barton, that's true. And they could play Barton a little bit of the three if they have to. But you want to give all those guys minutes and you want to see what configurations work. And one idea that you floated and we've talked about off air a fair amount is whether the answer to that is just playing Jamal Murray at the one and biting the bullet.
Well, with Moutier being so ineffective, I think you're at that point again. And the long term, I think this team could be just a monster offensively eventually with some of the talent they have. I just don't see how they're going to get to stopping anybody with the talent talent that's on the roster, even if it develops. But, you know, that wouldn't be the first Nuggets team that was awesome at offense and couldn't stop anybody. I think that Murray, though, he's got to get a look playing the point guard next to Gary Harris. And I think that there's a belief in the organization that he can play some point guard, at least have the ball in his hands, do more in pick and roll. He's basically playing mostly off ball right now. And while you can make the argument that, hey, you know, it doesn't matter, like if he's playing the two, he has the ball in his hands, who cares? But it's really a question of, are you playing next to Moutier, who can't shoot, and therefore your pick and rolls are going to be a lot less effective, and then Moutier is also going to need the ball in his hands a fair amount of time because he doesn't do anything else? Or are you going to play him next to Gary Harris or maybe even Will Barton, guys who are more off-ball players, and really have Murray the guy running the show every time? I would prefer to see all of those configurations, and I think his versatility might be helpful with those two. And I think also they really, the guys who don't fit on this roster are really Fareed, Nelson, just because he has to play, and they just have these other guys that they need to develop. And then Will Barton are the three guys who are pretty good on this team, or at least competent, but just don't really, they're blocking guys who are better than them. You could even maybe throw Jarrell Arthur into that category as well, though he doesn't really take as much off the table as some of those, but I really like Wancho needs to play more too.
I want to see Arthur and Jokic play a little bit to see, Arthur's not a perfect fit there, but to see if having a more defensively capable four makes for a survivable thing there. I like the idea of playing Gallo and Chandler together a lot, but just trying out some different affiliations and that sort of thing to make it work. But you're right, Wancho does need to play more. And also, they're in an unusual spot because those guys you talked about, Fareed and Barton and Jameer, they don't need to, particularly depending on what they do with the other spots, they don't need to get immediate replacements. Like, they can trade those guys for draft picks and flotsam and not lose anything in the rotation.
I do like it, and it's funny to say this because they're already at this point now where they're 10-16 and they're kind of not out of it yet, but looking like they're unlikely to make the playoffs, that now they finally went to actually starting their best lineup. It really was seemed more development focused at the beginning of the year, whereas usually you'll see teams just go with whatever they think is the best to win right at the start, and then they'll go more towards development towards the end. But I think they've decided to stop jacking around Jokic, and I think they've also come to the conclusion that that's their best chance of winning. And I agree. The second unit, though, for them is a little interesting. In that Portland game, what they did is they had Jameer, Jamal Murray, and Will Barton as your three smalls, and then Wilson Chandler and Fareed. That was against Portland, which is a smaller, kind of faster playing team. But I don't know how much I really care for that configuration.
That's a great spot to use Nurkic just broadly, but you don't want to use Nurkic and Fareed together because then your spacing is just jacked. So maybe Wancho would be a nice fit there, especially if Wilson Chandler then plays a little bit more with the first string, because you don't need any shot creation from that spot. You already have Jameer and Jamal out there. And a question I wanted to ask you was, if, and Adam Morris, our friend, has been talking about this, if Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic is the most important combination of players for them to evaluate, who would you play with them primarily?
Gallo, Chandler, and Harris. You've got a ton of shooting around them now. If you switch, Jokic is great at posting up on switches. You'll be able to get out and run. You've actually got like good switchability. Murray is going to suck on defense, but you got good switchability 2 through 4. You can get really space the floor around those guys. Like, that would, to me, would be a very, very difficult to stop offensive lineup. And you've got Harris can do a little bit extra playmaking. Gallo can, so you're not putting too much on Murray. I mean, to me, those are like the five guys that are really a big part of this franchise.
No opposition to that. I'd add in just spice things up a little bit. Sometimes Jarrell Arthur, sometimes Wancho, sometimes Will Barton. All of those would be worth seeing as well, but I agree with you on the core five.
Yeah, and Wancho, really, he's got to play more, I think. Like, I want to see him at that stretch four position, and he could get in there as well. I think the difficulty that they're going to have, though, and we'll move on in a second here from Denver, but the difficulty that they're going to have is Fareed, Barton. Those are guys who are good players. They're rotation players, but they're not going to want to give them up, but they're blocking the young guys, and they're not really that much better even than the young guys as well. I mean, I understand one thing, if you're trying to win and those guys are just way better than some of the guys that they have in there, but there isn't really a trade out there, and you feel like, hey, we're just going to have to move these guys, and they're not worth that much. We're not getting anything back. We don't want to give up an asset, but they're also just like clogging kind of clogging the pipes on your team as well. So it's a very intractable situation with that.
Fareed is stickier in some ways to me than Barton, just because his contract's a little longer and harder to trade. Whereas Barton, if that's your identification, you can just move him. He's a great value contract. It fills a position of need for a lot of other teams.
A few other little stats here that I thought were interesting. Jarrell Arthur doesn't look quite all the way back yet athletically from that knee surgery. And, you know, he's had a lot of injuries. This may just be a new stage of his career now where he's not going to be able to have the same effect defensively. But he's 12 of 25 on threes so far, which is impressive. Danilo Gallinari, only 42% on twos this year. He's having a little bit of a down year. He's turned 28. He still shoots, you know, in the low 50s at the rim, not getting to the foul line as much as he has in past years. And then Murray, only 50% true shooting, which is not great. You remember he missed like his first 15 shots of the year, but he's at 38% on threes. What's really holding down his efficiency is just that he's shooting like 16% on twos outside of 16 feet. And I think he's a good enough shooter that that's going to improve quite a bit.
I actually had another Murray stat that I wanted to throw out there, which is that Murray with Jokic and Murray without Jokic are pretty even samples. They're still on the small side because we're still so early in the year. He has a 53% true shooting with Jokic and a 42.4% without him.
Yeah, and especially if he's playing with both Fareed and Nurkic, some of their like really traditional two big lineups, it's going to be more difficult for him. We'll move on to Golden State momentarily, but first this from Helix Sleep, one of our original sponsors. And for those who are new listeners, the way I found sponsors initially for the show was I took products that I already used and tried to just get in touch with them. I actually sent a direct message to their company Twitter account and said, hey, I have this podcast that's doing okay. I love your mattress and I would really think I could be a good spokesman for you. And so we were able to come to an agreement. It's been going pretty well. A lot of listeners have appreciated using them at helixsleep.com/capspace, where you can get $50 off your order. And there have been a lot of mattress delivery companies in the news of late. It's definitely a better way to get a mattress because they cut out the middleman. You're not going to learn anything by going to the store and laying on a mattress for 5 minutes awkwardly with your shoes on while you wonder like whether you can put your whole body on the bed, including your shoes, or whether that's rude or whatever. And it's a totally awkward process. But what sets Helix Sleep apart from those other companies is they actually can personalize the mattress for you. You fill out a 2 to 3 minute questionnaire, you and your significant other together. If you have some difference in preferences, they'll actually split it down the middle for you for each of your preferences, whether you sleep hot or cold, a side sleeper, back sleeper, that type of stuff. And we did that, my girlfriend and I, and we both agreed it's the most comfortable mattress we've ever owned and way, way less expensive than some of these other mattresses that you're going to get in a store. It's basically $600 for a twin, a little over $1,000 for the California King that she and I own. It really just the most comfortable mattress you'll ever have, and you have 100 nights to try it out, so there's really no risk at all. They'll give you 100% refund and pick it up from you if you don't like it. So you can get the 30% improvement in overall sleep quality that Helix customers report. Go to helixsleep.com/capspace to get $50 off your order. We talk about Capspace all the time in the program. This is a URL, helixsleep.com/capspace, and let them know that you came from us. The Golden State Warriors, where are they?
23-4, 6-1 again, same as last time we did this. Second in offense, sixth in defense, 25% of the top seed in the West, 45% shot at the
75%
title.
75% chance.
Sorry, 75 top seed, 45 title. I thought I had right. Number one in the whole league, 67 projected wins. And I feel like the place we have to start, since we didn't record on it, is that weird, weird game against the Knicks where they were just assist hunting for three quarters.
Yeah, at one point, I think, was it their first 26 or the first 36 baskets, all of which were assisted. The streak was finally broken by an Ian Clark floater, and Steph joked after the game that they're gonna have to like go over the film with him and about how selfish he was. But Steph in particular was just ridiculous. Like, he was passing up wide open threes, driving to the rim, and then like he traveled because he was trying to pass it to Draymond Green at one point. It really got to like, I think they saw that they had assisted on every basket. They just wanted to keep it going as long as possible. And, you know, they're leading by 15 or 20 points the whole game against the Knicks, who, again, yet another team. Here, Carmelo Anthony, sore shoulder, one of those things where we hadn't heard anything about it. Derrick Rose's back spasms that had him out, he didn't play. So I think they've just figured Carmelo has this lingering injury and we'll just, you know, this is the time he probably could have played, but we're going to rest him. And then Kristaps Porzingis, Draymond Green, took issue with something that his Nike rep showed him before the game, in which Porzingis, fairly innocuous comments, but he did say, you know, next time I'll be ready for him, basically. And he was not ready for Draymond Green. Draymond just got right into him, completely shut him down. Kristaps, not really a good one-on-one player at this point against even average defense, and trying to deal with Draymond, he just wasn't able to do it. He was 3-9 from the field, wasn't able to do anything, even though they were trying to get him involved as much as possible, which shows that he still is at, Porzingis is still at the point where he's more of a play finisher than a play starter. But you know, it's good. Draymond likes to get himself fired up for these type of games, and whatever it works for him, because he has been playing pretty well defensively, obviously.
I was talking with Jared Dubin, our friend who does Locked On Knicks and many other things, after the show, or after the game, and I thought of the parallel, which I wish I would have thought of during the game, that it looked a lot to me like when the Warriors put Steven Jackson on Dirk in that play in the We Believe playoff series, and Dirk eventually got better at handling those kind of circumstances, but that a little bit smaller but strong and aggressive guy was something Dirk struggled with for years.
Yeah, and there was a time when he was able to, it was a surprise in that 2007 playoffs, because the year before he'd had Bruce Bowen on him, and he actually had killed him in that classic 2006 series between the Mavs and the Spurs. But yeah, I mean, Udonis Haslem was able to do that to him in the finals as well in 2006, and he did finally get to deal with that. Dirk, much better ball skills, much better off the dribble than Porzingis is ever going to be. And they just didn't have anyone who was able to get him the ball in pick and pop. But yeah, this is not the Knicks podcast, obviously. A couple other issues here. Their garbage time lineup, they just need another guard just to balance things out, so they're not playing three bigs at the end of the games. And even so that not only that, but Kerr has to leave the starters in, or at least some of the major players in, for longer, because he knows that the garbage time unit just like is going to hemorrhage points probably. And so if you just had a unit that you could be sure was not going to just get completely destroyed, that might help a little bit. West had an incident where he actually suffered a hip pointer against the Knicks. He was practicing. I think he's doubtful for tonight, but it seems like the type of thing where he's only going to miss a couple of games. Let me ask you this about JaVale McGee. Do you think he can actually help this team in the playoffs? Do you trust him to play like any minutes at all against good teams? I mean, maybe the first round, obviously, but you know, once they're playing teams that are really could potentially beat them.
Very limited against the right opponents. We've seen him really struggle in certain matchups where he just gets lost or commits a bunch of fouls. When he wasn't even on Anthony Davis for fair portions that game, and just drew and just got fouled Karl Anthony Towns a few times. But his activity level can certainly help, and the Warriors offensively know exactly where to find him. They're very comfortable with the idea of a rim runner and lob recipient, so it actually juices them up. So I wouldn't start the lineup. I wouldn't go to it like anything like that, but as a change of pace, maybe when the starters are a little bit tired, to maybe get them interested, it could work there.
Yeah, I share all of your concerns about his defense, his defensive rebounding, his pick and roll defense. He's not even really that great of a rim protector, frankly. He'll get some highlight blocks, but you know, he jumps 15 times for every block that he gets and leaves the offensive boards exposed or fouls or whatever. But the offense is so nasty when he's in there, because you just have to guard that lob play. And I mean, he had 17 points against the Knicks, and he had like probably five lob dunks on some really difficult plays too, where they really, Klay Thompson in particular, hooked up with him three times on some very difficult passes. I would try it. I think maybe like but it's one of those things where like, you got to just focus more on what he can do than what he can't, because the defense is probably not going to be good with him out there, but maybe your offense will just be so good that it doesn't matter. You know, like that's, and also I think if you got to do it against teams that aren't going to be switching against you, because once you're switching against JaVale, he can't post up or anything. Like he's doesn't have like the intelligence level to really take advantage of that kind of stuff. So you got to play him against a traditional big, but I would try. I think it's possible that he just juices the offense so much that it might be worth it. I also wanted to talk about Damian Jones. I spent some time looking at him. He had 17-9 in the D League last night. Most of that was just on post-ups, kind of longer jump hooks, not the type of stuff he's going to be doing, but he did showcase a decent touch. He doesn't have quite the level of explosion that someone like JaVale has. maybe not even quite like what Festus Ezeli did when he's really trying to load up and get off the ground before Ezeli was felled by those injuries. Not a guy who got a ton of alley-oops in college, but that's college. There's not as much space. I was impressed with just his overall touch around the rim, though. He shot 75% around the rim, and it wasn't all dunks at all. Like, as long he could be like really bodied and like not be able to go up strong sometimes. But other than that, like, he's got a pretty nice left hand. He's able to catch on the move and take a dribble, avoid people. So he's not like getting that high up in the air, but I think he can be a quality finisher. That was really all I looked at. I didn't look too hard at his defense because I didn't watch the whole game. And I just looked back at some of his college tape, but I was impressed with just his overall touch around the basket. Last thing you wanted to, there's another issue you want to discuss, right?
In that Knicks game, we saw something very different for the Warriors. They've maintained pretty consistent sub patterns ever since the beginning of the year. And what they did in the Knicks game is they flipped Steph Curry and Klay Thompson. So what that meant was that in this game, unlike basically every other one, Curry came out earlier in the first quarter and then started the second quarter, meaning he was playing with Durant, Sean Livingston on the perimeter and David West in that circumstance. And so I wondered what you thought of that.
Yeah, it was kind of odd. Curry played 20 minutes in the first half. I think Curry and Draymond together, I like that just because that's a good pick and roll combo. And then Klay and Durant together, if Durant's going to ISO, Klay can space the floor for him a little bit better. And those guys with Iguodala, West, Livingston, it's a pretty switchable lineup. They've got a lot of length on that unit. So I think I understand the thinking of why they do it the way they have so far. You have two of the stars on the floor. You separate out Curry and Durant because they're going to be the ones creating a lot. But, you know, Curry hasn't been playing as well this year as we talked about in that mailbag. I think it's worth trying. I don't think it makes as much sense, though. And I didn't really, against that Knicks JV squad, I don't think that we were able to really learn that much either way, frankly.
The weirdest part about it to me was that he didn't put Livingston in for Curry. He put Ian Clark in. And their shot creation in that unit, there was a time where they only had in, like, it was Clark, Klay Thompson, I believe, was still in, Durant was still out, so it was Iguodala and Draymond. It's just like a strange combination of players. And if they use Livingston in that, it kind of weirds out your shooting, but it could work. But again, this is just trying out different things. I fully expect that once we get to the playoffs, there will be more time with the best four players together.
All right, let's move on to Houston.
Huge success story for them right now. 20-7, 7-0 since the last time we did this. Their last loss was that game against the Jazz, which we were like, oh wow, look at how good Utah looked in that game. And Utah did look really good in that game, and then Houston hasn't lost since. Third in offense, 16th in defense, 6% chance at the top seed, 6% chance at the title, and right now they're projected to be the third seed in the West with 57 wins, which I think puts them one above the Clippers.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable, and I think their fundamentals are better than the Spurs, who are really outperforming their point differential at this point. The 16th in defense is the really sexy thing. Obviously, they had that 24-61 on three-pointers, which we'll talk about momentarily. I watched all of their three-point attempts in preparation for this. They haven't been playing really many great offenses lately. I think that's helping that 16th in defense, but they do have some good defenders on this team, right? Like the starters, Beverly, Ariza, Capella, like those can be pretty decent. And they were a better defense than they were an offense in 2014-15. So D'Antoni, despite the fact that, and 16th in defense, you know, they're probably like half a point away from being like 22nd. Like they've been in the 20s most of this time. So I'm not going to say that they're necessarily going to stop people or that this is solved. What do you think the chances are that they could actually like make it to the Western Conference Finals?
They're pretty significant as long as they get out of the 4-5, because if they're in the 4-5, they're not going to beat the Warriors to me. I mean, there's a chance,
right.
But if they can get to the 2-3, I could absolutely see them beating the Spurs or the Clippers in a 7-game series.
Yeah. And that is a good point, that if they could get the 3 seed and they're really, you know, they're like a game behind the Clippers and maybe 2 behind the Spurs in the loss column right now, you only have to really beat one of those teams. Their first round series will probably be pretty easy. I think that they're, unless they suffer some injury concerns, which could always happen, by the way, with Gordon and Anderson, but more on that later too. Yeah, I mean, with the way they're playing right now, you would have to say that I wouldn't favor them against the Spurs or the Clippers, but it wouldn't shock me if they beat them for sure. Let's talk about the Demo situation. We still bombshell again. I mean, this is like the 8th bombshell now. They have now, best I could tell, they did what's called a first refusal exercise notice, where they basically said, hey, we are matching the Nets offer sheet. When Monty Ennis didn't show up for his physical, they had the option of either leaving that contract in place or just returning him to restricted free agency and fixing it so he wasn't allowed to go to the Nets for a year under any circumstances. They did the latter of those, and then it was reported that they had in fact agreed to a new contract and the situation was resolved, and they moved the guarantee back. He was going to get a little bit more money guaranteed this year. It looked like it was going to be a win for the Rockets, and then all of a sudden he hadn't shown up, and there's a few days of radio silence, and then Jonathan Fagan reported yesterday that Demo has just been made an unrestricted free agent. And it's really impossible to know at this point what prompted that. Apparently there are still some issues. The Rockets statement said in consultation with both him and the league. So there really seem like there are a lot of issues going on here. You could say maybe he failed a physical, but that would mean that he had actually signed this contract. We didn't have a report that he actually signed that contract. It was just said that they had agreed to it verbally. So maybe he never even had a physical. There's going to have to be more that comes out about this. And it seems like, and maybe he did have a physical and his back was just so jacked up that they decided not to do it. I really don't know what's going on, but now Demo is in a big trouble because the Nets are really the only team this year that would have wanted him to pay him like a longer term contract with a fair amount. He could still go get like a room exception from some team or something, and somewhere where he could get some playing time. But, you know, no one has jumped on him yet as an unrestricted free agent. We haven't even heard about anyone being interested. So I really don't know what to make of this at this point. Do you have anything to add to that?
We don't know exactly what caused the latest bombshell to happen, but I keep thinking back to the decision not to report for the original physical, because if you have any chance that you're not going to pass your physical with the new team, because you've already gone through all that with the team that signed you the offer sheet, if there's any chance that you're going to fail that, especially if you want to go to the original team in the first place, just show up. If you show up, then you're basically, you're getting your money. And considering he already, whether it was dubious or not, already had that failed physical with the Pistons, which nullified the trade back at the deadline, I don't understand why you don't just do that. Yeah, maybe it's an imperfect contract, but you're guaranteeing a serious amount of money and a contract, in that case, you know, if you fail a physical to a team that you want to go to in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he could go play for some playoff team. Now, we can talk at another time about like who could actually use him at this point. That would be, and has the money. That would be an interesting topic for another day. But yeah, still more to be told on this, it would seem. So yeah, they were 24-61 on three-pointers against the Pelicans. They started it off with a play that they also use late in the game against Brooklyn that has been extremely effective for them. They'll put one of their shooters, either Ariza, who shot 14 three-point attempts in this game, Harden and Gordon both had 12. They'll put him at the free throw line while they're running a high pick and roll with Harden and Capella. And it's very difficult to stop because one of two things can happen. Either that shooter can then screen the man guarding the roll man. So imagine this, like Harden comes off the screen, the guy guarding the roll man, the center, has to help, and then that guy gets a screen right in his back and Harden can just go in for a layup. Or he can fake that screen, the guy guarding Gordon has to help out on Harden, and then Gordon or Ariza can just run back to the top of the key at the three-point line and get a wide open three. Very, very difficult to deal with. I think probably what you would have to do is, when you know that play is coming, you would just trap the initial pick and roll, but just to kind of throw off the rhythm of the play. But that, you know, you're not going to do that unless you really know that's what's coming in a playoff series. So it's very difficult to stop. That's an aside. The other thing that really showed up to me was so many of these shots are from two or three steps behind the line. Harden can shoot out there even off the dribble. Gordon and Anderson pulling up. Like Gordon, his release is so fast. He said in that game before, you know, this is a revenge game for he and Anderson, obviously, to put up these 61 threes and the NBA record of 24 against the Pelicans. Gordon said, hey, you know, I was just mostly a catch and shoot guy in Alvin's system. Now I get a chance to do more off the dribble. I don't know if that's even true. He's taking a lot of threes, it seems like. But the fact that you just have to close out so much further, and then you have that initial pick and roll with Harden and a roll man that's so difficult to stop. You have to get help, and now you have to close out another 3 or 4 feet. And then when when you get down in transition two, the idea of still people have the instinct they're going to go back to the paint. And then you have to close out not only the three-point line, but even further beyond that. It's just so, so hard to stop. It really is.
And if they're putting more strain, if they're doing a better job defensively, then that adds a little bit more cumulative stress, both physically and mentally. And I don't think they're ever going to be great shakes on that end just with their current personnel. They can be solid, but they can't be great. It's been awfully impressive. And the bench has been so much better since Beverly got back. Some of that is Patrick Beverly, but it's also having Gordon play more minutes there. Now their bench is actually above water. They're outscoring opponents by about 2 points per 100 possessions. And that was deep underwater. I think it was like 9 or 10 points before Beverly returned.
Yeah, this team, it's amazing that such a simple formula with just a ton of shooting, and you know, it's not like shooters like Ryan Anderson and Eric Gordon are freely available. You know, they're paying those guys a combined $33 million per year. But just one star, a role man, and some shooting could be so hard to stop. And I think that's probably too dismissive of D'Antoni's system and the type of freedom that he gives his players. But still also, I mean, he always has had offenses that I think were more than the sum of their parts. This isn't like his Phoenix offenses, though. I mean, those had like Amari Stoudemire is probably the best role man in history. Nash, not as good of a scorer as Harden, but, you know, probably a better passer, a better three-point shooter. You had like a Boris Diaw, Sean Marion, like there's no one as good from a ball skills standpoint. I mean, this team still only has one guy who can penetrate, although Beverly has been doing a nice job driving to the rim on the second unit, which Zach Lowe talked about. So this is not like one of those Phoenix teams offensively, but it's still very, very good. And we were skeptical a little bit of that hire because we felt like they needed to improve the defense. We were skeptical of the Gordon and Anderson contracts. They may still turn out to be bad in a few years, but everything looking great so far for Houston. And, you know, certainly I thought D'Antoni was the best coach available on the market, even if he wasn't quite fitting in with exactly what they needed. But it looks like he was exactly what they needed because this offense is just so good right now.
And Harden looks so happy and engaged. You know, they were such a disaster last year in so many different ways. And a lot of that partially due to the changeover of coach, partially due to the changeover of personnel. It looks like a completely different team. And they're on the short list of my favorite teams to watch all year.
Let's get to the Clippers now.
20-7, 4-1 since the last time we did this. That one loss was to the Warriors in that prime time game. Fifth in offense, second in defense, 3% chance of the number one seed in the West, 5% shot of winning the title, fourth in the West with 56 wins just behind the Rockets.
Yeah, they've been on this Eastern trip. They scraped out a win by a few points over Orlando. They scraped out a few points, a few point win over Miami as Hassan Whiteside kind of, I don't know how pejorative he was really trying to be, but he basically said, you know, DeAndre just does lobs. I'm kind of more skilled DeAndre. Outplayed him in that game against the Heat. The Heat will just forever lose to good teams by like 5 points. Like that's just every game that they play this year. It's pretty ridiculous. Austin Rivers had 25 and I think 7 threes against the Magic. I'm not going to overreact to that. When you shoot a lot of shots, sometimes you make a lot of them. Chris Paul, still at the normal level that he's been at, but his turnover percentage up a little bit from the otherworldly levels that he's been at previously. And after that great start to the season, again, settling in kind of right at the area that he's been in, which is still a wonderful player. Usage down a little bit last year with Blake back from last year now with Blake back. DeAndre Jordan, still we haven't seen any age-related slippage from him. I mean, I guess he is only 27, 28, but as a guy you more dependent on athleticism than most, you're always kind of looking for that. He's still shooting a little bit worse at the rim, but getting just as many dunks as he was. I wouldn't put anything in that. And then Jamal Crawford, he's been the guy who's really been kind of saving their bench. He's bounced back from where he was last season, a little bit more efficient. But part of that is driven by shooting 47% on mid-rangers. He's basically the same as he was everywhere else. And his shot distribution is worse. So is his free throw rate from last year. So we could see him take a little bit of a tumble back to where you would expect with another year in the books compared to last year. And also there's been a few games where he's played at the end over JJ Redick, and you know, that should still never absolutely happen. I think
no it shouldn't. The Clippers starters have still been very good, one of the most used lineups, one of the most effective lineups, and after that brilliant start, now they're being outscored by 2.1 points per 100 possessions when Chris Paul's off the floor. Some of that is garbage, some of that is bench units, but they're just not.
So that's overall for the whole season?
Yes, but considering they were plus,
because they had that great start, right. Like, so I mean, over the last like 15 games, they must be really bad.
They must be.
We've seen them go a little bit more staggery recently. And so you asked me this question, but I'll turn it back on you. if they did decide to stagger Blake and Chris more often, who are you putting in Blake's position there with the rest of the starters?
Unless you needed defense from that spot, like weak side for that, I'd probably go Wes Johnson.
That's my thought too. Yeah, he really has kind of been a little bit of a forgotten man lately, it seems like. And they've been playing Paul Pierce some more minutes too. And I think the last game that I looked at their minutes, he played like 3 minutes or something. And they've even been playing some lineups with like Austin Rivers at the three.
Yes, they have. And No.
Blake Griffin, I want to talk a little bit more about his performance too. He's shooting 67% at the rim, which is still solid, of course, but not where he was in his previous years, which was like 75%. The bigger issue for him is he's shooting only 29% on 3 to 10 feet. And that's basically all of his post-ups where he doesn't get all the way to the rim and he's not able to overpower guys. He just doesn't have that touch. He doesn't have the extension on his hook shot, doesn't have any kind of a turnaround jumper from closer range. So that's what he's really going to need to get better at if he's going to be efficient on these post-ups. We have sort of said, hey, his long twos, you know, it's hard to be efficient that way. He's shooting 44% on those shots. That's actually like pretty decent. Granted, still maybe not as efficient as the shots that he took early in his career. And it's also worth noting too, that he's actually taking a higher percentage of his shots at the rim than either of the last 2 years. So he has been able to get to the basket more, just not finishing it at quite the same rate. And it's palpable watching him too, that he just cannot jump the way he used to. We've hit on this a lot, but I think he has like 21 dunks all year, like less than one dunk per game. And in his heyday, he was getting like well over two dunks a game.
Do you wonder at all about how he would fit? Let's say they run it all back for a couple of years, which as my expectation right now with how he'll fit in with that as he ages.
You know, it's interesting because I mean, I imagine he'll still stay if they offer him the full 5-year max. He would have to make an all NBA team this year, I think, to qualify for the new supermax rule in the CBA. Because he'll have 8 years of experience, same as Steph Curry. And to get the 35% max, if he doesn't make an All-NBA team this year, he wouldn't qualify. I think he probably made it in 2014-15. I know he didn't last year because with all the injuries. And you have to have made it either two of the last 3 years or in this year. And he wouldn't be on any of my All-NBA teams right now.
The forward spots are stacked. We talked about this when we did that exercise at the end of the month. I mean, it's going to be hard for him to jump into that, even if the Clippers are playing at this level.
Yeah, so I don't know. You think that this year, especially with Paul aging, DJ aging, I mean, all those guys, I think, are on the wrong side of the aging curve now. Redick as well. So if they bring that band back together, and if they don't, then they have no way to replace any of those guys. I think it's just only they're going to kind of continue to dwindle from here on out, and we'll just have to see how things end up for them this year. If they make it to the conference finals, yeah, you bring them all back. If they lose in the second round and it's not close, yeah, you know, it's hard to see it. But I don't think that core is going to age particularly well other than Paul. Let's get to the Lakers now, though.
Sure. They're co-tenants at Staples.
Wait, actually not. Before that, let's do a read for SeatGeek. My girlfriend actually just used SeatGeek to get tickets for the Pistons-Bulls game since she's in Chicago right now doing for work. And she used SeatGeek, used that cap space code to get a $20 rebate off of her first SeatGeek purchase. So actually ended up being about half price for that game to see Bulls-Pistons. And you can do the same thing. She saved a lot of time as well by just being able to look at deal score, figure out which of the seats were underpriced, and buy them. You can do it. Really, it just takes like a minute or two in that free SeatGeek app. And so the way that you can get started with them as well, you download that free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab, click on add a promo code, and enter the promo code CAPSPACE, which we talk about all the time here on the program. And SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made that first ticket purchase. So save time. I think that's like the thing I like the most about the app at this point, even once you've used the CAPSPACE code. Save money as well to identify those underpriced seats, and you're done in just a couple of swipes buying your tickets. It's fantastic. Free SeatGeek app, promo code CAPSPACE is how you get started with them. All right, sorry, now let's get to the Lakers.
The Lakers are 11-18, 1-6 since the last time we did this, that win coming against the Sixers. 19th in offense, 28th in defense, 6% shot of making the playoffs, and they're projected to be 12th in the West with just 30 wins.
Well, Danny, the important thing about the Lakers, from your perspective, is that Tarik Black has now returned from an ankle injury and got 3 fouls in 3 minutes last night trying to guard Joel Embiid.
Just perfection. Absolute perfection. I like Tarik Black too. It's just that his
He's a good player.
His amazing propensity to foul is just life affirming.
Yeah, it is, and probably why he's not going to be a guy you can really start at center, even in a low minute role. Because you're just maybe he would get a little bit more respect if he were a starter from the refs, but probably not. One nice thing for the Lakers and one bad thing: Luol Deng is playing better now. In his last few games, he's been his last five, he has been over 30 minutes in each of those, except for one when they lost on the road in a huge blowout. But he's had, you know, he's 8 for 13, 7 of 11, shooting three pointers a little bit better. And I think the fact that Luke is playing him more is good to see, because he was having games where he was only playing like 20 minutes earlier in the year. Unfortunately, part of why he's playing more is that Brandon Ingram has not been playing as well. He's now down to a 6.6 PER, more troubling to me. I think his shooting will come around. A lot of his inefficiency is just because he hasn't shot jumpers really well. He's shooting 34% from the field and under 30% from three. But the bigger concern for him, a guy with his physical tools, playing on a team that has a reasonable amount of spacing on it, is he's only taking 17% of his shots at the rim. And he only played 20 minutes against Philly. That was the lowest he'd played in 15 games. Part of that was due to guys like Nick Young being out. So we might see Ingram's playing time dwindle down into that low 20 minutes, high teens level with Deng playing better, at least for the time being, you would think, until they really have decided that they're out of it, even though we know that they are, but they may not have come to that conclusion yet.
For an example of that, I looked it up, and 2 weeks ago, the Lakers' odds of making the playoffs were 25%, and now they're down to 6. So that is a reasonable crystallization. Yes, they were dealing with injuries during this time, and that should be noted, and it is noted. But the question I had for you was, from what we've seen so far, has this season changed your interpretation of Ingram's ideal long-term role on offense or defense?
You know, I don't know. The concerns that I had with him were a lack of athleticism. I think that has been borne out to some degree. That's something that he could still improve. But the comparisons to Giannis, to Kevin Durant, as we talked about in the last 15 and 60, not really warranted in terms of what he's able to do attacking the basket so far. Defensively, I think he's been solid. Has not been, again, the type of player in help defense, defending the basket that you might hope. But again, that's something that's going to come in time. And I think the fact that Luke has trusted him, that he's been able to execute the system, not screw up too much, I think that's something that is encouraging. I think he can be a very solid defensive player, if not like an absolute lockdown game changer type of guy. Maybe he becomes more like a Tayshaun Prince type of long defender than, you know, a Kawhi Leonard, really get a bunch of steals type of guy. He has shown the ability to dribble, if not really actually get to the basket. You know, he can get open for his jumpers a little bit, run some pick and rolls, and maybe he hasn't been asked really to be the guy handling a pick and roll. It's too early to say there. I think he's about where I thought he would be. I mean, when you consider his age too, he doesn't turn 20 until September of 2017. I'm not feeling hitting the alarm bells, but he hasn't been one of these revelatory rookies where you watch him and you're like, oh shit, this guy's gonna be really good. You know, it's kind of the flashes that we've seen from a guy like Murray. We have not seen that from Ingram. Like, has he had like a single highlight play all year that you can recall?
He had one nice weak side shot block that I remember, and he had a pretty good dunk at one point. There were two things I remember. I thought he's looked more comfortable with the ball in his hands than I expected this early. It's something, as you mentioned, young guys can struggle a lot with this. And I like him as kind of a weak side guy. We'll have to see defensively whether he can be more of a man-to-man. I'm what I've seen so far, I kind of like him better as a team defender, you know, in that executing. I think he knows what's going on, which is good, but at this point I'm not thinking that he's going to be that just throw him on the other team's best forward and set it and forget it. But if he can get his jump shot a little bit better, if he can become more confident with it, there's a piece there. But you'll just need that. He'd be better playing next to a let's say a Paul George would be perfect for him, so then he can kind of bounce between a couple different roles, be a supporting player on both ends, but do that without taking much off the table.
Playing for next to Paul George works for everyone except Monte Ellis to make him better on defense. D'Angelo Russell has come back from this sore knee when he had the PRP injection in. Looks fine. I thought he played a very nice in-control game. against Philly. Again, that's against Philly. They're going to that two bigs. It was kind of a weird vibe around the team in that Philly game with Noel playing and then complaining that he's not an 8-minute player and the front office needs to figure things out. Just the fundamental stats on him, 53% true shooting, right around league average. That's not bad for a second year point guard at all. Taking 48% of his shots from downtown, doesn't really ever get to the line, turns it over a fair amount, 29% usage, which actually is impressive, but taking only 11% of his shots at the rim, and he shoots 52% on those. I mean, he again had some attempts to finish. He just has no creativity finishing at the rim, no right hand, no explosion. It's not a good combination. It's really difficult to envision him being a guy who gets all the way to the basket effectively. At least he's not taking very many long twos. That's nice to see. And the 39% threes, you can be efficient that way when you're taking half your shots from downtown and you're making that percentage. The passing, he'll make the right pass. He has some good passes out of pick and roll. Again, I thought it was just a nice in control game against the Sixers, which is nice to see. You just don't see quite the wow plays, quite the explosion that you hope to see to really think this guy's gonna be a superstar. But I think he could be a good offensive point guard in the league for a long time. Of course, his defense has a little bit of a way to go. One of their biggest weaknesses, Russell turns it over a ton. Randall turns it over in like 20% of his possessions. He's one of the worst turnover percentages in the league, and they are 27th in turnover rate as a team. That's something that's really holding their offense back. And of course, you know, as you mentioned, their defense is terrible.
They have a lot of places that they can improve, and it looks now, I would say it still looks more likely than not that they're gonna lose their pick to the Sixers. So they're gonna have some team building challenges this summer. But when you're the Lakers, you have opportunities that other teams don't have.
Yeah, they also are not really even gonna have a max slot at this point either, it looks like.
Until they get somebody to take on Mozgov's contract for something, I guess. And that's true. Yeah. They can't trade a first round pick for a long time, even if they wanted to.
2021 would be the first one, or 2 years after that Magic pick.
Yeah,
would be the first one. Although if they keep this one, then the Magic one gets extinguished.
It becomes seconds.
I think they could then trade their 2019 pick if they do keep this one. All right, we're gonna take this to a part two here. Don't forget about our sponsors on this one. SeatGeek, use that cap space code to get a $20 back off of your first SeatGeek purchase. HelixSleep.com/capspace, $50 off your Helix Sleep mattress. And we'll be back in just a little bit for the second part of the Western Conference 15 and 60. Till then, thanks again to Capital One's CreditWise app for sponsoring us today. Capital One created the CreditWise app so you can check your credit score anytime you want right in the app. It's free to everyone, so download CreditWise today. Availability depends on presence of credit history from TransUnion. CreditWise is offered by Capital One Bank USA, N.A.